Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are speaking with one of the greatest chess players, at least since they've been keeping records. She is the author of the new book, Rebel Queen, The Cold War, Misogyny, and the Making of a Grandmaster. Our guest, the Grandmaster, Susan Polgár, started winning chess tournaments at age 4 in Hungary, won the top female player in the world ranking at age 15, was the first woman to earn the men's Grandmaster title by norms and rating, is the only player ever to earn all 6 of the world's most prestigious chess crowns, holds a world record for playing 326 simultaneous games and winning 309 of them. I could go on. She is also the only woman to coach a men's Division I collegiate team, Texas Tech, 2007-12, and Webster University, 2012-21. Her teams in the past 10 years have won more world championships, national championships, major titles, and Olympiad medals than all other collegiate chess programs in the U.S. combined. She is also the founder of the Susan Polgár Foundation, a nonprofit that promotes chess. Susan Polgár, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Thank you so much. It's my great pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for writing this terrific book about your life and career. If we can start a little bit at the beginning, when a kid is good at something and they're one of their parents or both of their parents are involved, people usually think they're being pushed into it. They're going to resent it. They're going to be mad at their parents. But your account is extremely positive and glowing of how your father in particular taught you. Can you describe what you think of how you were taught?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I discovered chess by a complete accident. I was at home as a 3-year-old, nearly 4, with my mom. She was preparing dinner. My dad was at work. And all of a sudden, when I was kind of searching for a new toy in the cupboard, fell out a wooden chess board, you know, one of those folded in the middle, and so fell the figurines, the chess pieces, and I got attracted to them. I asked, mommy, look at the little horsey, you know, and she says, well, this is not just another toy. This is a serious game, which she didn't play at all at the time. And my dad loved playing, but had no one to play with since his high school days. So that's how my story started. And I have to mention that my father by then had his visionary educational theories, in that he believes that any healthy born child is a potential genius or high achiever, if you want to say. And he didn't know what subject should be the test of his theories. But once I discovered a game and I showed the interest and eventually enthusiasm, as he introduced me to the game, actually, he said, wow, we found our subject. And him being a professional, a psychologist and teacher, and my mom is also a teacher of languages. So basically, the fact that they were teachers and my father found an amazing way to introduce me to the game, like this is a fairy tale, you know, with kings and queens and castles and all that. So he made it a lot of fun. And him loving chess and appreciating the beauty in chess, that was his angle that gave me his, that, you know, I got his passion, you know, the amazing games, the so-called evergreen game, and the beautiful queen sacrificing that results in checkmate and all that. So it's really thanks to him that he didn't really have to push me. I was just hooked on the game on my own.
Well, he made it fun and exciting and used positive, not negative reinforcement. I think these are pretty well accepted now approaches. And he taught you one piece at a time, but in a different way from what people might think. Do you think the way your father taught you is maybe the best way to this day to teach chess? Did you teach your sisters, and do you teach children now in the same way?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think I learned a lot from him. Later on, I have been teaching my sisters, who eventually became champions, chess champions themselves. And I had my own chess school in New York City for many years until even further later, I had my own, or still have my own institute, although I'm no longer running it, the day-to-day operations of it. Yeah, definitely. But at the same time, I should also say that it's somewhat individualistic, the approach, because something that may work for a four-year-old girl, the approach may need to be adjusted somewhat for a six-year-old boy, let's say, or a 12-year-old, you know, person. So, but yes, overall, I think he had a very good method that certainly did work for me.
In the book, you sometimes talk about how you play the games, and sometimes you talk about using intuition and going unknown places, and other times about having calculated many moves out. For us amateurs who never calculate many moves out, it still doesn't seem right to say we're using any special sort of intuition. We just don't have a clue what we're doing. But how does it work when you rely on intuition and don't know where you're going?
Well, you know, on a higher level or professional level, things can get really, really complicated. You cannot just calculate it as far as you'd like to calculate. Even the chess engines, the computers, some things are just so many options, so many variations, and there is no clear conclusions. And it's especially, of course, true for us humans. You know, obviously the computer is much more precise when it comes to those things. So, and also the other element is that when we play chess in tournaments, there is always a chess clock involved. So we have limited time, whether we're talking about the classical time control of long games to playing blitz games when you may have only 3 minutes each side for the entire game, you know. So with that restricted time, you simply have no choice. You have to largely rely on your intuition, which really means is relying on your past experience, right?
Yeah.
You will usually not have the same exact position, but you have similar positions. And you in chess, really, there are two types of positions, and that's what people don't realize, you know. There are the positions that are very concrete that you need to calculate very precisely versus situations when you can go by your intuition. And it's kind of, I think, the same really in our everyday life. You know, certain things are time sensitive, like let's say you catching an airplane or a bus or a train, right? You better be there to have enough time, go through TSA and get your luggage checked in, blah, 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 right? Versus other situations where it's more matter of your taste, matter of your intuition, which restaurant should we go for dinner tonight, right? So it's kind of along those lines that you want to, you know, at a higher level, but also I think in an amateur level, to be quite frank, is just that the better you are at chess, the more you sense it better. And that's the hardest part, really, to sense when is it when you can trust, go by your intuition versus there is a need for the calculation.
So
and that's the biggest difference between amateur players and professional, or let's say semi-professional players.
But if you're relying on your memory of past games, you need as many memories as possible before you're old enough to start forgetting them, right? So starting at four is a good idea.
Yeah, and that's one of the things when people ask me, how do I improve at chess? That's the one of the most important advice I can give. In order to improve, you need to analyze your games, learn from your mistakes, understand what you did right or wrong, so you don't repeat the same mistakes, and obviously utilize the good moves that you already know how to make.
We're speaking with Susan Polgar, and the book is called Rebel Queen: The Cold War, Misogyny, and the Making of a Grandmaster. In the book, you do run into a good bit of sexism, some anti-Semitism, but above all, it seems petty and spiteful government of Hungary. And in the US, you know, we sort of think of the communist governments encouraging and funding and training and celebrating people for playing chess, not harassing them for playing chess. What's the story with the Hungarian government?
Well, first of all, I want to emphasize we're talking about Cold War Hungary's government, not today's government. Once I, you know, broke various barriers, became Olympic champion for Hungary, you know, they became, of course, big supporters, and there is no issues there. But we're talking about the government in the 80s and late 70s. And yeah, it was very unfortunate, because what happened was, when I discovered chess and we started learning with my dad, he had this belief and theory, which obviously I embraced immediately, that our goal was for me to become the best I can without any limitations, becoming a grandmaster, becoming one of the best chess players in the world. Not just female chess players, but one of the best, right? Now, it's important to put it in perspective that up to that point, there were no women who have earned the men's grandmaster title.
Right.
There was, I think, only one or two women who even earned the previous title, the next best, second highest title, international master. So basically, what happened is, at the time, people didn't see any precedence of women becoming really great chess players, like as good as men. And therefore, they believed women should just play among themselves and not even try to compete with men. And that's what caused the friction between my family, myself, my father, and the chess authorities in Hungary. And they thought my father was absolutely crazy, which obviously he was not, in believing that a woman may be capable to similar accomplishments in chess, which is an intellectual activity, not requiring big muscles and lifting heavy weights on a physical term. And they thought literally that he belongs in a mental institution for believing that a girl, a woman, would be accomplishing similar results as men. And that because of that, they were punishing me in many different ways. For example, when I was a teenager and in my peak developing years, they revoked my passport, so I couldn't accept freely invitations that I had from around the world, to when I qualified to the men's world championship cycle from the national Hungarian championship, they said, you cannot compete because that's the men's world championship and you're a woman, and so on and so on. So unfortunately, that's what that was about, that they simply couldn't understand the vision, and they wanted quick successes for Hungary in the women sections. In the meantime, I believed, my family believed, that in order to have even a chance to become like Garry Kasparov or Anatoly Karpov, Bobby Fischer, you know, as of their chess accomplishments, I need to have similar kind of training as well as competitions and so on. And the two wouldn't be compatible. And that's really what caused all the friction.
Until you and your sisters won the Olympiad for Hungary, and then they were happy to support you.
Absolutely. That was 1988, absolutely life-changing event for us, because up to 1988, the Soviet Union has triumphed at every chess Olympiad that they participated in for women. And this was the first time that they got dethroned, and incredibly by practically one family. We had one other girl, Ildikó Mádl, who was part of the team, but we were really the majority, great majority of the team, and as well as the points that Hungary gained to win gold. And from then on, when we went home, starting with arriving at the airport in Budapest, there was a large crowd of people celebrating. We were on the cover of every newspaper, magazine you may imagine, as the Golden Girls, all of a sudden, one day to another.
I'm sure to this day there are men and women who believe that women cannot compete at chess and be grandmasters, never mind the facts, but that's changed a great deal, right? The sexism with regard to chess.
It improved a great deal, and I'm proud to be part of that revolution, being one of the pioneers in changing people's minds. When I earned the Grandmaster title as the first woman to do so in chess history, I'm proud to say today there are 42 women who have the title. So we came a long way, and we are still a long way to go to prove that there will be more, even more women in the very top of the chess world. But we came a long way. But we also had to fight a lot of discrimination, a lot of sexism, even to this day, even if to a lesser degree.
You mentioned Bobby Fischer, whose name people have heard. You got him to admit to you directly that he had changed his view on women. Can you talk a little bit about how you met him to begin with?
Yeah, that was such a fascinating story. Growing up throughout the Fischer boom in the early 1970s, and I discovered chess within a year from the famous Fischer-Spassky match that's called the match of the 20th century, obviously, that put chess on the map back then. So after that, he retired. He was kind of in hiding. He didn't play chess for the longest time. 20 years later, he came back and played a second match against Boris Spassky in the neighboring country to Hungary, Yugoslavia. And after that, that was a very politicized match, obviously, because of the Yugoslav war and all that. Long story short, he was basically in hiding after that match because of his anti-American statements and so on. Coincidentally, what happened to be the case, one of the main organizers of that match happened to be a Hungarian, ethnic Hungarian Yugoslav man who was a friend of our family and a big fan of our family. And he said, Bobby would like to meet you. And said, wow, living all my life up to that day, admiring the myth, the legend of Bobby Fischer and his games, obviously. I said, wow, how is it possible that he wants to meet me? So my family went first to visit him. I happened to be in South America at that time. And when they went and he realized I wasn't going, he said, how come Susan is not here? So they explained the situation and he says, make sure she comes next time. So as soon as I came back from Peru, where I was at the time, this is we're writing May 1993. Of course, I was excited that the legendary Bobby Fischer wants to meet me. I was curious to meet him. So I drove to where he was, which was right across the Hungarian border in a little place called Kanizsa. And we hit it off right away. He, at the time, was very much involved in thinking about revolutionizing chess yet another way with creating his version of a chess variant called, at the time was called shuffle chess or Fischer random chess, meaning that behind the eight pawns on each side on the second rank of the chessboard, there are the chess pieces, right? So there is that traditional setup of the pieces starting from the two sides, the rooks and the knights and the bishops and so on. He said, because chess opening theories have been so deeply analyzed, even by then, that it takes away a lot of the essence of the game. That the ultimately you want two intellects to battle it out at the chessboard. And a lot of it becomes chess research and memorization of those variations and so on. So his idea was, let's just randomly mix up those pieces and start the game that way. So what happened was, initially the way we were playing, we would set up the eight pawns, and then the first eight moves of the game would be each of us alternating moves with setting up the pieces one at a time, not symmetrically, or not necessarily symmetrically. And then after those first eight moves of putting the eight pieces wherever we wish, the game began, really. And so it's very fascinating, actually, that we work together on finalizing those rules. And eventually, he learned from mathematicians that even if you have restrictions of keeping the two bishops on opposite colored starting squares, keeping the king in between the two rooks, maintaining the rights to castle, there will still be, and keeping it symmetrical for both sides, we'll still keep 960 different starting positions available. And
right.
It's fascinating that today, in fact, in recent months, it became very much in the news. And that version of chess, the Fischer Random, well, they can call it chess 960, based on the 960 possible starting positions. They call it freestyle chess today also. But basically, all of that started with Bobby and I in 1993, experimenting with it, playing countless games, and coming up with the finalized rules, which people do play with today as well. So it is definitely a fascinating memory for me, and nice to think back of it.
Wonderful to make an improvement to a very old game that's
yes,
been played the same way for a long time. I have to ask, and you mentioned it in the book, and then much more recently, the film, TV series of The Queen's Gambit. What did you think of that? And is your own story the closest story to it that's not fictional? And what's believable in it, and what's not believable in it?
That's a great question. And to be quite frank, it was probably one of the catalysts of my book. Because after the series came out, I got countless requests for interviews, and people just at large were asking me, was that based on your story, right? Because there is the obvious similarity in that a young girl succeeds in a man's world of chess, right? So that's obviously the obvious parallel. There are, of course, plenty of differences as well. First of all, I grew up in during the Cold War in Hungary, while she was in America. She grew up in an orphanage on tranquilizers, while I was in a loving family and supporting family who helped me with chess. The part I honestly did not like about the movie, while most of it I think was great, well done, is that they somehow implied that taking all kinds of pills may help her perform better at chess tournaments. I think that's definitely untrue. None of us are aware of, in the chess world, of any kind of pills that would be even able to help you, really. In fact, the contrary. So, and also about her lifestyle in her later teenage years, as of, you know, drinking and all kind of a hippie lifestyle, that would be part of her success, that's kind of hard to believe, you know. But overall, it was a great promotion for chess. And because of the movie, people kept asking me, you should make a movie of your life story. That's the real thing, which it is in some way. And when I started exploring the idea and talking to friends in Hollywood, they were telling me that if you want any kind of control of how the movie will play out and will be presented, you better have your memoirs written so the movie potentially could be based on your book, and rather than taking its own life and kind of become fiction completely.
Very good. So we're reading the early version of the movie that we will hopefully be.
Well, at this point, that's a fantasy and may or may not ever happen, but I hope it will, because honestly, the message of the book is that there are so many situations like what I went through, that when you have a vision and people tell you, no, forget it, it's impossible, right? Like in my case, becoming a grandmaster in chess as a young girl. And I'd like to encourage everybody, and hopefully they can get a little bit of source of inspiration from my book, that despite all the naysayers, despite everybody that tries to pull you down, if you have the passion for something, if you want it badly enough, if you're willing to work hard enough, nothing is impossible. So that's really my message with the book. And eventually, if maybe one day there will be a movie made out of it, I'd like to inspire everyone, and especially young girls, that don't give in to the naysayers, believe in yourself, work hard, and that's key. And you can persevere and succeed. There will be always people trying to pull you down. It's part of life. But as long as you have the passion and the desire and the willingness to work hard, you can get there.
And it's actually a more inspiring story and a less common story that anybody can do it if they really, really work hard and train for hours every day, compared to if you're born with magical gifts or if you find the right drugs and alcohol, you can make it happen. Like, that's not
it's
actually
more realistic, inspiring. Let's put it that way.
It's more realistic. It's maybe a little less Hollywood, but I think it could make a better movie than the one where you just have to find the right pills. We have just a couple minutes left. Susan Polgar, you've been promoting chess for years now, and it seems to be working, right? It's more and more popular.
Yes, I'm very happy to see the progress that chess has made in my lifetime and also in my time in the United States. I founded the Susan Polgar Foundation back in 2002 to raise visibility for chess, to give more opportunities for girls in chess. And I definitely see a great growth. When we started out back then, there were less than 1% of the US Chess Federation's membership being female. Nowadays, even 10 years later, when we check back, it was close to 15%. So we're making progress. And also, I think in general, at large, the popularity of chess has grown in big numbers, partly thanks to Queen's Gambit, partly as one of the few benefits of the pandemic we had. Online chess is booming. Chess people play chess everywhere. So I'm very excited, and I look forward to even further growth.
How can people find your foundation or get in touch with you? Is there a website?
Yeah, very simple. Just susanpolgar.com. From there, you can have a link to the foundation, which is polgarfoundation.org. So I look forward to connecting with more people who would like to help in promoting chess. Obviously, chess is a wonderful educational tool also to develop many very valuable life skills as well.
Wonderful. We have been speaking with Susan Polgar, and the book is called Rebel Queen, The Cold War, Misogyny, and the Making of a Grandmaster. I highly recommend it. We will have links up at talkworldradio.org. Susan Polgar, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.